Transforming Rehabilitation and Reforms. And I've been doing this field work and interviews, but I've also been writing a book with a sociology colleague on the criminalization of hacktivism and hackers. So as part of this latter project, I spent a lot of time unpacking many of the ways that the courts and the prison system deal with computer crime and technology more generally. And obviously this is a wide area. It includes things like wrestling with the sheer volume and unwieldy character of the data entered into evidence, the issues surrounding the capacity of defendants to access that data while in custody to build a viable defense, as well as the sort of explicit interruptions that arrest, conviction, and punishment visit on a defendant's digital self. And here you might include everything from a blanket ban on accessing computers of any kind, parole and probation conditions that often prohibit the use of anonymizing software, or special monitoring software that's installed on a prisoner's hardware while on license. So these kinds of practices, I would argue, supplement the physical and spatial experience of custody and confinement with digital shackles. It's also worth noting that these sorts of restrictions become more onerous and more impactful the younger and more technologically immersed an individual is. And it's not just prisons, right, but the courts also must weigh the impact of network technology on how they go about business. I was just in a high court hearing 2 weeks ago for one of our informants, and the Lord Chief Justice, right, before starting the hearing, had to apologize to spectators to tell them that they couldn't tweet, you know, live tweet the trial, and then had to, you know, reassure the journalists that they were allowed to live tweet the trial, right? And law enforcement as well, right, has seen the potential of network technology, right? There's a case now going before the American Supreme Court, Carpenter v. United States, which is about whether or not law enforcement needs a warrant to access cell tower location data, which they've been doing for a number of years. So on the one hand, I'm thinking and I'm writing about these issues, and on the other, I'm spending a day a month conducting interviews in prisons. And I've interviewed in prisons before, I've been to a lot of prisons, right? It's not my first time. But perhaps because of this wider context, this time I found it a bit of a jarring effect. And, you know, obviously mobile phones are not allowed, digital recorders, right, need to be pre-approved, right? There is this kind of time machine sense, right, that plenty of scholars have noted. But also, it's a recognizably modern institution, right? In the sense this time machine analogy is a bit flawed, right? I didn't feel like I stepped into an industrial age, but in a distinctly analog, sparse space. And this is echoed in the absence of visibly integrated technology, heightened by the clinky jingle and the step of staff, because they wear these big, thick, you know, leather belts with long chains attached and jailer's keys. And so I think that this transition from the digitally dense to the analog and sparse that I just briefly set up is increasingly a transition that carceral scholars must theoretically and empirically reckon with. I think it's obviously a transition that incoming, incarcerated, and recently released prisoners reckon and possibly struggle with, but which remains relatively unquantified and unacknowledged in the algebra of deprivation that animates the prison system. So in the time that I have remaining, I'd like to begin sketching out some points on how this intersection between the digital and the analog might play out in the context of prisons and prisoners. Well, talking fast. Okay, so first I'd like to just outline what the state of prison digitalization looks like, right? I'm going to be brief because there isn't really much there. There are two digitalization pilots underway. There's one at HMP Wayland in Norfolk and one at HMP Berwyn in North Wales. And the images are from HMP Berwyn. So Berwyn just opened in February. It's new. It's a Titan or super prison. It holds about 2,000 prisoners. And according to the prison service, it's the largest prison in the UK and the second largest in Europe. Some particular point of pride there. And most of the prisoners there are serving sentences that are over 4 years. And Wayland is about 30 years old. It's also a fairly large prison. It's 1,000 strong male population. And again, the prisoners are also serving over 4 years, and there's a significant proportion of them that are also life sentence prisoners. So there's a suite of digital technologies that have been introduced in these two prisons. Electronic service kiosks, which we'll talk about in a second. They're kind of like ATM-style tablet freestanding things that are in communal areas of housing blocks. There are in-cell desktops or laptops, which connect and replicate basically the kiosk services and also provide a connection with a tailored piece of software, which is called the virtual campus, which we'll talk about in a second. And then there are in-cell telephones. So that's basically the kind of cutting edge, right, of prison digital services. Now, there's a much broader kind of penetration for the virtual campus, which is basically a secure web-based intranet system, which provides exams and courses, it provides employment-related material, and also increasingly is adding rehabilitative content. So it's present in about 105 prisons in England and Wales. So it has a very large coverage, but it's effectively sandboxed. So it doesn't connect with the internet or the outside world. It does connect with like two or three whitelisted sites, but in general, it's been flagged up in numerous reports as always being problematic, sporadic, barely working, underutilized, and characterized by a lack of access issues. And the numbers kind of bear that out, right? 105 prisons. But when you look at the actual users, there's only like 30,000 users. One third of those, right, had logged in actually, right? And half of those, I don't know if you can see that, half of those, so 5,000, right, had logged in just to set up a new user account, right? So, if you think that 85,000, the prison population is like 85,000, right? 5,000, right, is like really no penetration at all. What's being kind of claimed as a panacea type technology are these kiosks, they're available in all the private prisons and in three public prisons, and this is just straight off of UniLink's website. But there are a lot of claims that are made, right, about the kind of efficiencies that it generates, you can see over here that often a lot of them are kind of quantified in terms of staff hours saved, full-time equivalents, right, freeing up staff work that would otherwise be done doing paperwork and kind of putting in applications and whatnot. In general, these technologies are touted as valuable because they automate non-essential functions and economize a large line item in the prison's budget, food, paper, form filling, and they reduce staff stress. That they also decrease prisoner frustration or potentially help responsibilization strategies gain more traction is billed as a secondary unintended benefit. So I would argue that these technologies need to be conceived as gains in the efficiency of control and governance rather than as gateways to the digital experience. But there are other kind of technologies, or at least semi-technologies, what I'm calling Trump real technologies for want of a better term, that purport to actually extend this kind of digital experience, right, for prisoners. And so two examples of that are the job search feature on the virtual campus and the email a prisoner email program. So basically, right, you can send an email from this website, also owned by contracted by UniLink for 40p to a prisoner, right, and then the prisoner can reply to you, right, by email as well. But of course, right, these do not actually come in virtual form, right? They get printed out, so you email the prisoner gets the printed out version, right, in the mail drop, and the same thing happens, right, on the way back, right? You get a post in the mail. And similarly, right, with the virtual campus, right, it's a fairly live database, right, but you print out an application and then you send out the application, right? Like, you don't actually do that, right, because you did it virtually, but someone in the prison office does. Right. So I think Trump real tech points to this kind of anxious characterization of cyberspace and its perils that kind of animates the way that the prison schizophrenically trying to deal with the digital world. It kind of imposes a de facto blanket ban on connecting digitally with the outside, and I think this is an important supplement to the kind of recent rethinking of the relationship between the prison and the outside world done by carceral geographers, criminologists, and others. When we discuss whatever term we use, neoliberal penality or prison industrial complexes, right, the emphasis has been on the idea that prisoners are no longer, if they ever were, the sort of closed, completely removed total institutions posited by scholars like Goffman. Right? We've become accustomed to thinking about prisons as permeable, riven with movement, propelled by revolving door flows inside and outside the community. Well, contra these insights, it's clear that one's digital identity, one's digital footprint, do not go through the gate. Indeed, these novel, emergent, and yet increasingly intimate aspects of ourselves and our interactions with others stop short at the prison door. In fact, this injunction is so dominant that digital artifacts like emails or job applications can only traverse the prison gate once they've been converted into material form, right? In this case, paper. And I think this is a point that kind of bears dwelling on, right? The prison is so spatialized, so bound up in its physical existence that it registers in cyberspace as an absence, a lacuna, or a negative space. If you think about it this way, right, just about every institution, company, place has some kind of digital analog, but the prison is a non-place in this kind of way of thinking about it, and by extension, its citizens also lack a digital presence or existence. So this begs the question, right, is it that the prison wants to protect the world from itself, right, or is it that the aim is to protect the prison from the world, right? And you can certainly think of reasons why one should be cautious, right? You can think of the WannaCry bug that affected the NHS this summer, or the recent ransomware attack in Mecklenburg County in North Carolina, right, where basically the system is completely seized up, right, and they have to process prisoners by hand, right, because they don't want to pay the ransom. You can think about all kinds of problems with, you know, trolling, taunting, harassing victims, predation, right, that might unfold, right? So I'm not discounting any of those. But we can also, in some ways, think about this kind of emergent sociological and political theory literature, which talks about the quickened tempo of economic and technological processes and the emergent synchronization gaps that are appearing, right, between these areas that are quickly revolutionizing life, right, and the political and administrative institutions of the state, right, this kind of social acceleration speed literature. It's clear that many aspects of modern self-management and life are increasingly losing their paper-based material anchors, and I'm not just talking about online banking or shopping or housing or job searches, all of which are largely now online, but also state services, right? Like things like taxing your car. Right? And so I think this is a real problem, both in terms of the links that prisons can provide with resettlement needs and what prisoners must contend with when they get out. I had lots of examples, but I don't really have the time to get into them, but I can give you some concrete examples. Right. So to summarize, I think what I've been sketching out might elicit is kind of three ways to frame digital incapacity, both as a supplement currently to the carceral experience, but increasingly will become a more unique element of punishment. So first, we can think about digital absences. So as we experience more and more overlap between the digital and the real world, our co-presence in both becomes an important facet of daily life. We're not just talking about, you know, the paperless world, but we're also talking about evolving social norms and mores, about how to interact on social media and in different online contexts, right? How we recognize bullying, harassment, stalking, all kinds of, you know, things that people can get into trouble with, right? All this requires practice and use, and it's changing. I had one informant tell me that she often has to assess the resettlement needs of prisoners that have been in prison for 10 years. Yeah? So just think about that, 2007, right? Apple introduced the first iPhone in 2007, right? Facebook started to broaden to people besides the Ivy League in 2006. Twitter was founded in 2006, right? So imagine going into prison, right, with Twitter, Facebook, technology being in that state, right? And having to come out and, you know, think about being released into a world where you have to order things on Argus or Ag, right? This inflects the prospect of release with significant anxiety. We should recognize it. We should also think about digital suspensions or interruptions, and here I'm thinking about when younger generations come into the prison that have grown up, you know, kind of in a digital world, right? And how that changes, right, those interruptions. What happens when, right, in your network of friends, people disappear and their feeds disappear? How does that change, you know, kind of the kind of support structures that people are embedded in? And also, right, what do people do in response, right? Do they start to come and visit, right, when they can no longer quickly just, like, kind of, you know, send you a text or what have you? And finally, I think, this generates, right, so digital absences and digital interruptions or suspensions also generate vulnerabilities, right? And here, right, you know, you're releasing people into a world that's full of breaches, right? Phishing scams, cybercrime, identity theft, you name it, right? If you have no fluency and no capacity to kind of engage with this material, right, you're incredibly vulnerable to its exploitation. So I'll leave it at that because I think I'm over time, maybe I'm not. So I welcome any questions. Thank you.
You had 9 seconds, so.
Oh, right, yeah.
So no, under time. Questions, yes?
I think I've read through your paper and enjoyed it.